905.
Out of the box.
Out of the box.
Record collections and recollections. Out of the box on FBI Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Marcus Whale and I am here on FBI 94.5 broadcasting today on Out of the Box from Gadigal land. We pay our respects to elders past and present always on this land. I'm so excited to be here in the studio with Ingrid Dierkman, who is currently the head of programming at Golden Age Cinema and Bar, I suppose.
Cinema and bar, you know, everything. They do food. They do a lot of things. It's many spaces.
And also, famously, the smooth, like impossibly smooth MC, Ripper performance artist, Ripper Gently, as whom you hosted the incredible, legendary DIY cinema night, Pink Flamingo Cinema.
Smooth's the way, I would say oily. Like,
yeah. Oily. Yeah.
But, yeah, Pink Flamingo, rest in peace.
Rest in peace.
Semi-permanent hiatus.
I love how you're constantly hinting at a possible future for Pink Flamingo Cinema.
Yeah, it's very diva. It's very like, is that it? Maybe, who knows? Little tease, but yeah.
It's so lovely to have you here in the Out of the Box studio today to talk through movies and music and also your life, which I've always been quite fascinated by, being that you are often behind this persona, this sort of mustachioed persona as Ripper Gently, this kind of camp John Waters looking thing. Although, honestly, I think you're probably a lot smoother than John Waters, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's a front. Obviously, it's like flop sweating behind the scenes. But yeah, I mean, the persona was, it was a drag persona that got repurposed into hosting, because the first time I was hosting or like introing films at Pink Flamingo, I was really, really nervous. So it became this kind of, not barricade, but it became this buffer between me. Because that way, you know, if I mess up, if I screw something up, it's not me, it was the character.
Exactly. Yeah. Having that deflection is so, I think, freeing, liberating in some ways. And that's maybe what some people don't understand about putting on a persona. It almost makes you more able to be honest.
Yeah.
I want to start today by asking you about how you got into making movies, because you're also a filmmaker. You, as a kid, growing up in
Toowoomba,
South Queensland.
Yeah.
Did you make movies as a kid? Did you have a kind of, what was your way in?
The way in was, I mean, really obsessively watching movies, talking about movies, because, you know, it was prime, like, video rental era when I was growing up. So that was just a bit of a DIY education in whatever you could get, stacks of weeklies. And then wanting to make films came from doing a lot of drama, kind of drama kid stuff, and then wanting to fit films into like however I could. So trying to figure out a way to make that work for like, usually didn't manage to pull it off, but if we could, you know, do like a science assessment, if there's some way that we can pivot this into like, what if it was actually like a short film that we shot in my friend's backyard and we did effects for it and did that kind of thing. So yeah, any way that something could be related to movies, I was always trying to find a way to bring it around.
Do you have a sort of early memory of a particular movie or movies that you rented that really stuck with you and made you think, oh, okay, well, this is my world now?
I mean, the first movie I can remember watching was a movie I wasn't meant to be watching. We're at my grandma's farmhouse and my cousins had rented Creepshow 2 and I wasn't meant to watch it because it was very scary. But I had like snuck out and was peering around the door into the living room. There's this sequence where a bunch of teenagers are on a raft in the middle of a lake, and this horrible goo monster like gets them and sucks them down, and I was absolutely terrified. And so that was my first movie watching moment, this like absolute just quaking terror hiding behind the couch.
How old were you at that point?
I would have been like 4.
Ooh.
Yeah, so just old enough to like recognize that like something horrific is happening, but not able to differentiate that like this is pretend, this is just a movie.
Do you remember the first time that you had a camera in your hand, or at least like in your vicinity, making one of these assignments, say?
Yeah, it would have been my friend's dad's camera, because they weren't, it was kind of pre like really accessible handy cams. It was still a like, oh my goodness, he has one of these. It was quite a big deal. So just this sense of like having to be very, very careful with it, and having like, this was this like precious, very expensive piece of equipment that you like, you couldn't drop, you couldn't break. So yeah, I would have been like 12, I want to say, 12, 13, I think. Yeah.
And these assignments, did you have a kind of, this is a crew of people that you were making movies with?
We didn't manage to successfully make many movies. It was more of a, like, get a couple thing. There were some friends who, it was really just whoever we could kind of, like, rope into doing stuff. It was always easier to, you know, let's put on a play, let's do that kind of stuff, because the mechanics then of trying to make a film, it was really just whoever you could get enthused about it for a weekend, and roping in like, hey, you know, you're my friend's little brother, you're going to be in this whether you like it or not, so get in front of the camera and do this. Then as now, it's really just trying to get people interested enough to give you their time and not drop out halfway through. That's the real, as long as you can get their stuff done, you're like, okay, cool, great, good, we're done. That's the real trick.
Do you think that DIY spirit in your present day, do you think that came from what you just simply had to do what you wanted to do back then?
Yeah, definitely. And right through to film school as well. Like that was, I kind of went to film school at a weird time when it was transitional period where some people were still shooting on film. Digital cameras were not yet at that prosumer level that you could really just, you know, have them look great and filmic. So just getting something made turned into a real ordeal.
You've come in with a really amazing playlist of songs, Ingrid. The first one on the list is from maybe one of the most iconic dance scenes in cinema history, I feel. Rhythm of the Night by Corona.
Yeah.
And this, like the other songs that you've chosen, are music moments from films. This is from Beau Travail, mm-hmm. the late 90s?
Yeah, Claire it's Denis about 99 movie. Claire Denis. Yeah.
Tell us about this scene and maybe this movie as well.
This scene and this movie in particular, when I saw it, shifted something in me. It was one of those real, like, I can't believe what I'm seeing. It felt, I don't know what you say, thrilling. It felt thrilling to watch. I've always been drawn to use of music in films that's a bit more diegetic. So rather than like, oh, it's a cool needle drop that's existing over a montage or something that's playing out, this club moment with the character, if you haven't seen Beau Travail, but you should, the character at the end is in this liminal space, kind of both physically and emotionally. And I've seen so many people try to do, I've tried to rip it off myself, this kind of cathartic dance moment, but I've never seen it executed better, I think, than this man dancing alone, just whirling manically by himself in a dank club basement to Rhythm of the Night.
The kind of context of this is that the rest of the movie is mostly these brutal desert military drills,
mm-hmm.
that are so, everything's so physically contained and intense, and it's like the world is really relentless. But it's sort of this freedom that you see in the way he's dancing feels so, like, for me, it feels so powerful, the way you described it.
Yeah, no, it's just an incredible moment, a real punch.
This is The Rhythm of the Night by Corona. See if you can picture in your head little Denis Levant grooving on this strange dance floor. You're on Out of the Box.
This is the rhythm of the night. The night. Oh yeah. The rhythm of the night. This is the rhythm of my life. My life. Oh yeah. The rhythm of my life.
You're listening to Out of the Box on FBI 94.5. My name is Marcus Whale, and I am so pleased to be in the studio with Ingrid Dickman, who is talking about, well, we're talking about your life.
We're talking about life. We're talking about movies. We're talking about viewing your life through the lens of movies. Yeah.
That was The Rhythm of the Night by Corona, of course, but viewed through the prism of the scene at the very end of the late 90s movie Beau Travail, an incredible dance scene there. Okay, so next up, Ingrid, I wanted to ask about your relationship to performance. So do you remember, you've sort of hinted at having a drama moment in your life?
I had so many drama moments in my life. But yeah, doing performance stuff, very like, yeah, school-based, very much an indoor kid. So yeah, lots of drama, AV club kind of stuff. But started doing performance as part of speech therapy to get over a speech impediment when I was a kid. And then, just kept doing that and spent as much time as possible doing, any sort of drama stuff, because it was a way to, as long as you were doing drama stuff that was an acceptable school activity, so you could kind of be left to your own devices and put on your little plays and stuff.
Do you remember any particular moments in performance that you were like, oh, okay, this is good for me, this is comfortable for me?
Yeah, well, there was a really, because I went to an all-girls school, there was a really interesting unintentional mode of performance going on where they didn't want us performing with boys because that was, you know, obviously that way leads to sin. So instead, you know, you've got these male roles, you've got Shakespeare or something, well, someone's going to have to play them, so a girl will just, like, put her hair back and put on a pencil mustache and a suit, and for all intents and purposes, they are now a man. And that just became this accepted, like, everyone, we all just instantly buy into the fiction of, or not fiction, but performance of what is happening here. And, you know, I remember people from, like, co-ed schools would be like, isn't that weird, though? And like, no, on stage. That's a man right now. Off stage, not anymore. So, yeah, that was a really unintentional intro to, like, getting weird with gender.
Do you think it's acceptable to draw a line between those experiences and the pencil moustache suit-wearing persona that you have now, Ripper Gently?
It's a direct through line. It's an absolute through line. Like, I know people who do absolutely amazing things with their drag, incredible contouring and incredible, like, there's a real, you know, a huge difference between how mine, not so much. And that is partly because I'm not as good at makeup, but it's also an intentional thing that this thin line of liquid eyeliner over my mouth is what now signals what I'm doing with this performance. It's an invitation for someone to just join you in suspending your disbelief.
And did you also do drama outside of school? Were you kind of one of these kids that was like, I can't get enough, I need to do an extracurricular?
Yeah, no, it was pretty much all the time, as much as I could. Extracurricular drama stuff, like youth group kind of things, you know, someone from like the council would hold a thing in a town hall and you'd go along on a weekend. Yeah, as much as you possibly could. Partly to engage as little as possible with like being in Toowoomba. Yeah.
Do you have a memory of when you birthed the Ripper Gently persona and where that came from and what that was doing?
Yeah, I'd done some performance stuff on and off since moving down south. So there was, bits and pieces of performance art, hadn't really settled on anything. And then someone I knew at the time kind of, not dragged, but like very much pushed me along to a drag night that they were doing. That was a very last minute thing, helped me get in drag, and was like, cool, we're doing this now. It was very spur of the moment. And I think having to, rather than like thinking, oh my God, I'm dreaming, I want to do drag, I've been practicing this for so long, building it up, just basically, you know, one afternoon, like, no, you're doing this tonight, and then having to just do it meant that it was this like instant kind of hit, this instant entry of like, oh wow, just like that, huh?
You have chosen a song by Roy Orbison on your playlist tonight called Crying, but we had a little chat about it. So you wrote in your message to me that this is a song that's been in a lot of movies and there are a lot of kind of moments for it, but we had a little chat and decided on this moment in Mulholland Drive where the singer Rebecca Del Rio is singing Crying in Spanish. Do you want to talk about this song and maybe why is it so cinematic? How does it fit so nicely?
Yeah, I mean, Roy Orbison is one of those interesting, like, he has a cinematic quality. He's got a very, like, almost melodrama quality, both, like, tonally to his voice and also in you know, the song content. Crying pops up in quite a few things. It's in Gummo. It's all over the place. But this one in particular, this interpretation from Mulholland Drive is interesting because it occurs within, once again, it's diegetically, it occurs within a club, and there is a moment of reveal that it is lip sync, that this is not. So the singer falls away and the song continues on. So it's again, that dropping that pretense that we have all agreed to believe that she is the one singing, and when that is kind of yanked out from under you, it's a really discomforting moment.
It's almost like, you know, maybe that moment in the Catholic schoolgirl play where you think to yourself, maybe this is not a fully grown man with a pencil moustache.
No, maybe that, but you know, we're just going to play it like it is for now, and we'll all agree.
All right, this is Rebecca Del Rio from that incredible scene from Mulholland Drive, Llorando, Crying, on Out of the Box on FBI 94.5.
Yo estaba bien por un tiempo, volviendo a sonreír. Luego anoche te vi, tu mano me tocó y el saludo de tu voz.
That was Rebecca Del Rio performing Roy Orbison's song Crying in Spanish. Mm-hmm. From the incredible Club Silencio scene in Mulholland Drive, as selected by my guest in the studio for Out of the Box right now, Ingrid Diekman, the head of programming at Golden Age currently, the performance persona, Ripper Gently, filmmaker. It's been wonderful having you here in the studio. I've got you here for the next half hour. There's no escape.
Oh my God, they've locked the doors.
Okay, so you moved to Sydney pretty soon, maybe as soon as you could?
Yeah, basically as soon as I could. I think you finished school when you were 17 up in Queensland, so by the time, pretty much straight out of school, moved down, found a course at UNSW that wasn't being offered elsewhere, and came straight on down, basically. I mean, when I go back to Queensland now, I like it quite a bit, but it's still not necessarily somewhere you want to stay forever.
What was your experience at film school like? Did you find it as inspiring maybe as you hoped, or is it something else?
It was inspiring, not in terms of getting to make the things that I wanted to make. I didn't make anything I actually liked at film school, which I think is a lot of people's experience.
Mm.
Some people, you know, they have a very clear idea and they have a very clear artistic voice and it happens, boom, and they just build on that forever. I made a lot of garbage and but I was exposed to a lot of really interesting films. This was at Sydney Film School, which I don't think exists anymore, but they had a pretty wonderful and really eclectic curriculum of experimental films, like Stan Breckage kind of stuff, and really experimental documentary kind of works. So yeah, in terms of like, did I make anything good? No, but I got to watch a lot of good stuff.
Is there something in particular that really opened your mind in that time that maybe created a path towards where you are now to some extent?
Yeah, I think I have like a very strong memory of watching the film Irma Vep, which is an extraordinary piece of cinema. Just for so many ways, it's something that's always stuck with me that I always return to because it's got so many different modes of working in it. It's kind of a, you know, making of a movie sort of almost documentary style thing, and then it goes into like these bizarre flights of fantasy almost, and then at the end goes full on scratching on film experimental. I'd never seen anything quite like it that blended so many things together to such a satisfying whole. So yeah, Irma Vep was one that really...
That really, I think, speaks to the, again, the multiple modes of style bringing to attention the things we were talking about before, a little bit about the suspension of disbelief and the level of performance and artifice at play in movies. Is that something that you responded to and have responded to in your interest in the movies?
Yeah, definitely. It was... very much putting in that, by foregrounding the artifice and by acknowledging the artifice, you're, I don't know, inviting the audience in. You're inviting them into a bit more of a dialogue with you. It's almost like you're not trying to, it's not that real Carney mindset of like, oh, I'm trying to put something over on these rubes. It's like, no, I acknowledge that you're looking at me. I know what you're looking at. So that engagement and different ways of playing with gaze and audience response is something that's just remained a fascination.
Did you have... So a lot of people go to film school and then maybe drop it off and go and do something else, but did you sort of pursue that avenue at that time?
Yeah, temporarily. It was a pretty good time in Australian film industry. You could get, like, jobs as a runner. I did a lot of work as, like, second boom, which is the backup boom swinger, so you're pretty low on the ladder in that, but it was something that you could get paid work doing on pilots, low budget movies, that kind of stuff. Worked in that for about a year. Had a not great time in the industry in general. It was a pretty weird time. A lot of real creepy dudes and some not great times, and got pretty burned on it, unfortunately. And then drifted for a really long time, didn't make anything, didn't engage with making anything for 5-6 years. Yeah.
And how did you come back into making films? What was the sort of re-entry moment for you?
It was really getting back involved with making stuff for other people. I had no juice of my own. I had nothing that I could kind of even imagine making, like total creative block. So it became a bit more of a workmanlike kind of thing. Getting back into editing, first of all, people who I knew getting me to edit a show reel, say. So very mechanical, very like block it all together, do that kind of thing. Shooting music videos or BTS or something like that for people's stuff where I didn't have to have the creative, you know, energy for it. It was almost like for hire kind of work. And from there, working in that for a long time and finally getting back to like, oh, I think I want to make something of my own again.
We'll talk about this after the next song, but do you think that reforming your relationship to filmmaking was to some extent about the involvement, like you've said, the involvement of other people, but maybe the involvement of a particular scene or an area or a kind of, you know, I think I'm hinting at was there a new way to look at filmmaking through your situation?
Yeah, it was like a lot of it was being immersed in like Marrickville warehousing kind of opportunities. So there's, you know, for a time there was space. That was the main thing. There was space at a premium. You could have a set. You could have room to do stuff. You didn't have to be limited by what kind of mumblecore thing can I shoot in my friend's apartment, you could really actually think about, rather than thinking about constraints, you could think outwardly about what you can actually do. And there was a lot of stuff going on. There were a lot of people around. So it was, yeah, there was kind of like resource rich, I guess, is one way of looking at it, environment. You could be like, hey, kids, let's put on a show, and people would.
All right. Thinking about, again, going back to this film music, I'm curious about what of the sort of remaining songs you've chosen might fit into this scenario.
Might fit into that scenario. Let's see. Probably Maniac.
Ooh, okay.
I think is the closest one.
Maniac, Mui next, and Peaches.
And Peaches, yeah. Mostly because it's a Peaches track, and I guess that kind of like mid-2000s era. Look, there was a lot of electro clash going on. It was a very Peaches-heavy time. So when I think about something like that, it does remind me of like, oh, wow, yeah, 2007, what was going on there? This was...
That was, oh God, it was such a time, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a movie scene attached to this song?
Yeah, this is the one of the songs from the movie Flashdance from 1983. This is the from the classic scene where she is, she's just been a welder. It's not Water Feeling, that's the other one, but it's her doing her incredible kind of workout routine, just a steel gun girl on a Saturday night looking for the fight of her life. It's an incredible song in the film. It's really dynamic. It's another one of those transcendent dance moments. And the original version is good, but this one has a little more to it.
All right. Moulin X and Peaches with Maniac on Out of the Box, FBI 94.5. Peaches and Moulin X with a cover of Maniac, as you probably recognize there on Out of the Box. My name is Marcus Well. I'm here with the head of programming at Golden Age Cinema, Ingrid. Oh.
Hi.
Thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
So I just wanted to talk a little about the beloved, the undeniable, the legendary Pink Flamingo Cinema, which was so dear to many moviegoers' hearts in this city for all the incredible kind of cult movies that you showed, often movies that people don't get to see in public with other people. There was a real kind of beautiful niche following. It took place in Mothership. Tell me how you sort of came about putting that together.
I mean, I had been to other people's movie nights a lot. I had been to, Mumison Archives, J-Cats and Miss Death. They'd been running that for decades in various pub spaces, warehouse spaces. And that sort of mode of a curated movie selection that, yeah, sure, you probably could watch elsewhere, but creating a time and a space and presenting it, talking about the film, introducing it, explaining why, you know, you personally picked this film. It didn't just kind of appear on programming. So there's been a lot of amazing people around Sydney in particular who've done that for many, many years. Wanting to do it myself partly came from having done ad hoc kind of versions of that over the years, you know, throw up a sheet in someone's warehouse, play a Dario Argento movie, we all have a fun time, but that those didn't have that movie-ness quality to it. So for me, it's not just about the watching a film in a space with people. That's great and fantastic, but that can happen lots of different places. It's almost the idea of how much can you strip back the concept of a cinema and still get across the idea of you are in a cinema. And the ends end up being seats. The ends end up being a whole like lot of rows of red velvet seats that were acquired from a old theatre in Newtown that was closing down very quickly and needed to shift them on. And once those came in, everything just instantly felt like, oh, it's movie time now. Yeah, so this idea of, like, how do you strip it back to the bare signifiers of cinema, a screen, seats, in the dark, with people. Yeah.
And how did you decide to approach the programming then, now that you've got this cinema with seats and a screen and people?
I mean, there was a decision made early on by me that we would get rights for as many films as possible, which was challenging, but it's something that I wanted to do to kind of set it apart from other stuff I'd done in the past, and try to move towards something that was a bit more, not legitimate, but that wasn't quite as, like, underground. At first it was very ad hoc. It was stuff that I could, whatever I could get the rights to. So a lot of public domain stuff, a lot of stuff through the Something Weird catalog. If people are familiar with them, they are a tremendous archiver and restorer of old science fiction and Doris Wishman movies and, yeah, basically all sorts of incredible ephemera that would have been lost forever if not for them. So they helped me out a lot. Umbrella helped me out a lot early on. But it was very ad hoc. It was just whatever I could get. A Gladiator movie one week, horror of Party Beach the next week. So, yeah, very, like, late-night cable Svengoolie sort of thing. And then a couple of years ago, started working with a co-programmer, Joseph Pallas, who had an idea of wanting to play Alex Cox's film Walker. And I was a little wary of working with someone because I was quite protective of what I was doing. But we cooked up and I, well, why don't we make it a themed program? Why don't we do that? So that became the Outlaws program, and that kind of really clicked everything together. Then we had a, like, each season has increasingly more, like, esoteric and high concept themes, from, like, monstrous feminine, theatre of cruelty, stuff like that. And then once you start brainstorming that, it becomes like, okay, cool, well, what about this one? What about this one? What about this one? Yeah, once you can get together this, a program that's a bit more than, like, it's noir in November, you can really get granular with it and create something where all the films interact and talk to each other and have, like, a cohesive thread between them.
One of my favourite things about that programming format was walking into the Pink Flamingo cinema and you'd have trailers for the entire season before the presentation, and sort of made it feel like, oh, okay, we're in the Pink Flamingo cinema season, like, this is a 5-week event, and making it feel like that commitment that you make to going to the movies is more than just like, oh, we'll go and go see something tonight. That to me really gave a very special atmosphere to the series as it went along. Can you tell me about the if you had intentions for, like, what the community of filmgoers would be like, or, like, how you wanted to foster that?
No, like, that was honestly the furthest thing from my mind. I kind of approached this very backwards. The main, like, impetus for it at all, I remember, came from, it was a Sunday afternoon and I really wanted to go to the movies and there was nothing, absolutely nothing on that I wanted to see. And I was thinking, this shouldn't happen in a city this size. There should be something. I should be like, oh, they're doing a Kurosawa retrospective at something. And that's changed a lot now, partly because of places like Golden Age, the amazing programming that's going on at the Art Gallery New South Wales, and many, many other spaces that have popped up and doing fantastic stuff. But yeah, it was really like a selfish desire to, like, well, I want to see them and hopefully some other people will as well. And then it naturally, I think, particularly as it became more curated, you know, will naturally play a lot of, like, queer cinema because that's what interests me. And then so the people who come along with that, but no, it was very backwards. There was no, like, identify your demographics. It was a bit of a, like, if you build it, they will come.
And maybe that's where the spirit comes from, because it's so uncontrived and organic, and we hope that it comes back. I'm curious, what was the first movie you put on as Pink Flamingo Cinema?
It was a set of a couple of movies. It was over a weekend. The very first movie was called Mock Up on Moo. It is a extraordinary collage-based film by a filmmaker called Craig Baldwin, who runs a cinema called Other Cinema in San Francisco, I believe, who also helped me out a lot when I was getting started. He has distribution rights for the Kuchar Brothers films. So he helped me get Sins of the Fleshapoids and a bunch of their other fantastic stuff, The Craven Sluck. All-timers. So we played his movie first, paired with Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Wow.
Because it's a classic.
Can you tell us also about the collaborations that ended up happening maybe increasingly with Pink Flamingo Cinema, with, say, Gun Reflex and Static Vision?
Yeah, I mean, Gun Reflex found us, really. They came along to a very short-lived kind of like queer shorts night that I played a few times, and they played an incredible film, very explicit, very messy, very funny, very Gun Reflex, and I was really taken with it. So when they mentioned that they wanted to do their night, Gun Reflex, which is an extraordinary evening of stuff, everything from TikToks to like incredibly like high concept art pieces, because they're just great at getting people to give them their movies. So yeah, those were pretty amazing things that could only happen in an ad hoc space like that, because a lot of their crowd was kind of there to watch films, but also there just to like hang out, really. So yeah, those party atmospheres. Static Vision, the incredible distributors, festival runners, doer of all kinds of things, likewise, were, yeah, just people who were like, hey, we like what you're doing, we want to get involved.
You've chosen a song, the title song of Across 110th Street by mm-hmm. Bobby Womack. Tell us about this movie and maybe its significance to you.
This movie is a bit of an outlier for me, because it's one of the ones where it's from that era, particularly Blaxploitation era, from that era of movies having a title song with them. So you've got your tie, and you know, you had your Shaft, that was obviously the big one. Across 110th Street is an interesting one. It's much grittier, it's much darker. It's like when people are thinking of Blaxploitation films, they're thinking of a bit more in the excess and a bit more in the Rudy Ray Moore kind of outrageous stuff. This one stars Yaphet Kotto, is a, I don't know, it's really tense, it's an incredible pop thriller, and it's just got this amazing resonant song by Bobby Womack, which is the title song for it, that, I don't know, to me just, it's the perfect movie song. It delivers that bombastic, memorable, you associate it forever with this film.
Across 110th Street, Bobby Womack. Only got another 10 minutes with Ingrid Dickman, the current head of programming at Golden Age on Out of the Box. See you in a bit. The title track from the gritty 70s movie Across 110th Street there by Bobby Womack on Out of the Box. I only got a little bit more time here with Ingrid Dickman, the head of programming at Golden Age Cinema and Bar.
Cinema and Bar in Surrey Hills.
I think now's the time to talk about this new job that you have.
Now's the time to talk about Golden Age. I mean, Golden Age has been, it's an experience. There's definitely a lot more riding on it when you have to play movies every single day of the week rather than just once a week for a short program. New releases, all of that stuff. But it's also meant that I've been able to delve into giving things a chance that aren't maybe in the Golden Age wheelhouse. We played the new Kelly Reichardt film when that came out. We were the only cinema that was interested in doing that, I guess. And we can do stuff like long-form retrospectives, like the Jim Jarmusch series that we're running at the moment. We screened Patterson last week. Coming up on next Monday, we've got Only Lovers Left Alive. And then every Monday after that, we're going backwards chronologically in his filmography, which is very exciting. A lot of those films just haven't been available to play, to screen for a long time and just kind of became available. So, yeah, getting the chance to foster something like that has been really exciting.
You've also had some events as well recently. You've screened the Mood Ring film by
Yes, Delhi G's. Oh my goodness, yeah. that was a wild thing. People spilling into the aisles. It was like, oh, chaos, but fantastic. And yeah, exactly the kind of thing that I'm so happy that a place like Golden Age, you can do that kind of thing. You can support her. Like, yes, we'll do a screening.
Cinema is alive in Sydney.
Yeah, I'm also having that kind of mixed use space where it can be club nights, it can be DJs, it can be live bands, they can bring in jazz, they can do so many other things. This it felt almost like Pink Flamingo transferred over because it can be that third space that does so many things. It's not just movies.
The last song on your playlist tonight is from another really iconic music moment in a movie scene. It's the a cappella of Back to Life by Soul to Soul, which plays at the beginning of Belly, the Hype Williams sort of crime thriller noir. Tell us about this one.
This one is, this is one of the absolute favourite films that I was ever able to put on at Pink Flamingo. It played in the Outlaws season. It's just such an extraordinary film, and I like that we're going from like a perfect closing song to a perfect opener song. Watching this, it's I don't know, one of those things you really have to experience. All the money's there on screen. So much of the movie's budget was spent on this opening incredible slow-mo into this chromatic club environment, to this extraordinary score. It's perfectly orchestrated. It's like a ballet. And Hype Williams, obviously before this, had done really shaped the look and feel of R&B and hip-hop music videos in the 90s, and it just brings it to that. The rest of the movie is really good as well, but absolutely nothing can live up to this opening. Everyone should watch Belly. It's a heck of a film.
Please do it. This is, I think, my favourite scene in the history of movies.
Yeah.
I can't get past this point, actually, in the movie. It's been so wonderful having you in the studio today, Ingrid, telling us all these stories about Sydney movies, your life. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Stay tuned. We got lunch next on FBI 94.5. But for now, this is Back to Life, the a cappella version by Soul to Soul. Good evening. Good afternoon. Good day, good morning.
Steady, are you ready?